There's no one more closely associated with junk bonds than Michael Milken, who in the 1970s realized that investors could make more money buying bonds from companies with lower credit ratings than they could from companies with AAA-rated bonds. Through this realization, Milken and the firm he joined out of graduate school, Drexel Burnham Lambert, revolutionized the way companies and new industries were financed and made Milken and Drexel wealthy beyond their dreams. However, the same competitive nature that made Milken millions ended up hurting him in the end. In April of 1990, after 4 years of investigation and prosecution, Milken pled guilty to 6 counts of violating securities law, spent 1 year and 10 months in prison, and paid a government fine of $200 million and put an additional $400 million in a fund to compensate investors. Both before and after his incarceration, Milken has been heavily involved in philanthropy and now leads the Milken Institute, among many other organizations. He recently sat down with Carlyle Group co-founder David Rubenstein. They spoke on David Rubenstein's Bloomberg television program, Peer-to-Peer Conversations.
You signed the giving pledge, agreeing to give away half your money. What did your children say about that?
Well, it's interesting. They've been involved in our philanthropic efforts since they were young. And my wife, Lori defines wealth as that she can buy any book she wants. And so I think that's been instilled in our children from the very beginning.
You met your wife in high school?
We met in seventh grade.
Seventh grade. And you've been married for how long?
Well, we just celebrated our 50th wedding anniversary.
Okay, congratulations. Impressive. Okay, so you didn't date around when you were in the seventh grade? You just...
Well, we didn't really... We dated maybe once in the ninth grade.
Okay.
But, you know, she knew who I was. I knew who she was.
Okay.
She was voted in high school the most likely to succeed. So I wanted to hang around her as much as I could.
But what were you? You weren't voted that?
I was voted the most spiritist, friendliest at that time.
Okay, so you grew up in Los Angeles, is that right?
Yes. My father was a lawyer and an accountant, and my mom was a homemaker. And yes, I got to work. Anyone who's the child of a person has his own accounting firm, you know, you get to work on balance sheets and tax returns when you're 8.
Okay. Did you, at the early ages, were you a pretty good student?
Well, I was a very good student, but what they did instill in all of us is that for us to have a meaningful life, at least everyone had to have a chance in a meaningful life. And if our children or our children's children were going to have a meaningful life or a good life, then all children had to feel they had that opportunity. And that was instilled with us.
So you go to Berkeley, and you're going to major in science and be a scientist and so forth. What happened? Why did you change?
On August 11th, 1965, what became known as the Watts riots occurred. So I didn't have to go to Vietnam. There are armed personnel carriers on the street. The city is on fire. And it took a while for me to convince my dad to let me go and understand what was happening, because I was convinced I knew everything. And I met a young African-American man who was sitting outside looking in a building that had burned down that he worked in. No one would give any financial support to his father or to him because he was an African-American. And it struck me that I thought I knew everything, and now everything that I believed, a chance to succeed based on your ability, not who your parents were, not where you went to school, not your religion, not whether you were their man or a woman, that this individual had made an irrational decision watching the burning down of the building that employed him, and that he felt he wasn't part of the American dream. So I went back to Berkeley, changed my major to finance and business, and was determined to change that so that everyone felt that they would have access to capital based on their ability.
You majored in finance and then went right to business school at Wharton, is that right?
That's correct.
You had the highest grades in the history of the school, more or less?
There's that rumor that that happened, yes.
Okay. So you graduate from Wharton in 1970, and you're working for Drexel, which is a leading prestigious firm then. But it is said that you discovered the idea or helped to propel the idea that investing in what's called high-yield bonds was a better investment than investing in, let's say, investment-grade bonds. Is that more or less it?
It is. One of the ways I was able to convince the firm was I took a look at the stocks they were recommending. And most of the companies were non-investment grade. So here they're suggesting you invest in the equity of businesses, but not suggesting you could buy preferred stocks, other part of the capital structure. It's, you know, if we look at it today, David, you know, the rating agencies, about the lowest you can be rated before you go bankrupt and then you get a D is a triple C. Well, let's think of three firms that are in the news today. Uber, companies worth tens of billions of dollars, doesn't have a lot of debt relative to its equity. Well, it's rated triple C. You're talking about Tesla, doesn't have a lot of debt relative to its equity. It's rated triple C. And or you can go to WeWork. They're rated triple C. So what I discovered was quite often the future in credit is rated low, even though it's the future. And the real risk lies often in companies that we think of as establishment or have paid dividends for a long time.
All right, so you're doing reasonably well. Living in Philadelphia, and you go up to New York, you're commuting back and forth?
Well, the person I went to work for, who was the chairman, got in a serious accident. And so they asked me to go to New York and set up the bond department in New York for the firm. So I had my 2.5 hour commute each way.
And you're doing that at what age were you?
I was 24.
You're 24 years old, and they're having you set up their operation to lead their effort in New York?
Yes.
Okay. So, did you, like, try to look older than 24? Or?
You know, it's funny you say that, David. In 1974, I'm in Hartford giving this talk to the insurance companies, and a person said, you know, we have a lot of young people coming up here. We generally don't like to listen to anyone under 30. I said, I fully understand that myself. And so I was 30 for a number of years. You know?
So you told people you were 30. Okay. So your father comes down with cancer, melanoma, and you decide you'd want to move back to be closer to him. So you went to people at Drexel and said, I'm moving the operation to L.A., whether you like it or not. Or is that how it worked?
This was an unusual period of time. All these theories that I had at Wharton and at Berkeley, everything that I had studied for from 65 to 74, I was able to apply. And all these theories turned out to be true, and the modern capital markets began. But my mother-in-law had breast cancer, and my father had melanoma, and I could not solve the melanoma problem for my father. So I didn't really get to bask in the sun of your theories in finance and markets and change that occurred, because I now face really the first problem in my life that I could not solve. My father was dying, and I made the decision. We had two young children that they needed to meet my father and spend time with him before he died. And therefore, I was either going to take a sabbatical, or I was going to move the whole department to Los Angeles.
Okay, so everybody moves out to Los Angeles, and they fall in love with the California lifestyle, I guess, and they're probably not wearing ties to work or anything like that. Is that true? Or?
Well, they're not wearing ties to work, but, you know, I had the clock set on New York time. So when you came in, if you came in at 4, it said 7. You know, it psychologically gives you a little boost.
But you got to get up at 2 to do that or something?
3.
Great.
But and then,
okay.
But then at 4 o'clock, you send them back to L.A. time. You get your second win.
Okay.
So you get them back to
what? Right. So if somebody wanted to start a new company like Ted Turner, or Rupert Murdoch, or John Malone, they had to come to somebody like you to get money, and you would give them high yield bonds. Can you explain how you kind of invented high yield bonds for people to get new companies off the ground, as opposed to traditional today venture capital?
I will take you back to 74. So what happened in 74? The banking system had to save itself. Growth companies they were denied capital in this period of time. And therefore, once you saw the performance, the decision was, you don't want to rely on your financial institution for access to capital. And so to de-risk America, to de-risk the entire system, you want to have 10,000, 100,000 institutions like your own at Carlyle who could invest. You don't want to be dependent on a handful of banks. In 1998, when the Asian crisis started in Thailand, there were five banks that got in trouble, but they were providing the capital to everyone in the country. So to understand the future, so if cable is the future industry, of course it's going to be rated very low at the beginning. But if you can find the most talented people and give them capital to grow, and that was really the mixture. Let us go find people that are talented. So you mentioned Rupert Murdoch. Rupert wanted to build a company. He has passion for what he's done. He almost lost his company when he was in school in England and his father died in Adelaide and they tried to take his family company. So he remembered that, but he wanted to build something. Ted Turner wanted to build something. And so you're interacting, Craig McCaw, his family was in cable, was in radio, was in television. They were willing to give all that up for Cellular. You wanted to find that individual who had passion for what they were doing, and if you believed in them, finding great people and backing them is obviously one of the great decisions. And so bringing capital to them, they might be low rated. And there was only 500 companies in America rated investment grade. So you can imagine, I'm coming to Wall Street. I have umpteen million companies, and everyone else is focused on 500. And those 500 don't create jobs.
Did you ever somebody come to you if you didn't finance them and they actually turned out to be successful ever later? Did that ever happen? Or
I'm sure there was, but there were plenty where the idea didn't make any sense. You know, I remember we had a presentation on investing in an oil drilling business and an oil exploration business, and they brought them in, and we wanted to see their data. And about an hour into the meeting, I asked them what technique they use, closeology. And I think one of the things I've discovered over the years, if you don't understand something, ask what it is. A lot of people don't ask. They don't want to show they don't know. But I had never heard of closeology. And so their drilling technique is they see where others drill, and they get as close as possible. There's no geology. Okay. There's nothing going on. Okay. So we decided not to finance that company.
Okay. So you're at the height of your power. You are the most important person in finance in the United States, I think most people would probably say at the time. And then all of a sudden, some people didn't like what you were doing and investigate, and ultimately you leave Drexel at a very important point in your career.
Okay, you might have thought that I was the most important person, but, you know, I don't view that world. The most important person was the person who's responsible for running that business. We can help create the capital structure, but the other person's responsible for the business. We can coach them. We can talk to them. But yes, long before I left, in the mid-1980s, there was legislation introduced in America to ban the deductibility of interest for non-investment grade debt. So if you're one of these 500 companies, you're entitled to borrow and deduct interest. But if you're not, then you're not. We were so surprised by the reaction of congressmen or senators. One told us that, you know, if their state has to sacrifice to get rid of the scourge of junk bonds, by that time there were junk bonds, that they would sacrifice at that time. So the idea that you were going to deny capital to smaller and medium businesses who were creating at this time 100% of all jobs was kind of reminded me of the nobility in England with the mercantile class, where you went to the king and said, okay, we can no longer compete with these businesses or this people. So therefore, you have to deny him access to capital.
You ultimately left the company and you started different businesses, and then you came down with prostate cancer. You were told that you didn't have very long to live. Is that right?
It spread through my body. So I actually had to lay down for almost 24 hours and think about it. I had lost 10 relatives to cancer. And so I had to think, okay, what can I do differently than they did? So the first thing I decided was I'd stop eating anything except fruits and vegetables. This idea that it may be something that I was eating was accelerating the growth of cancer. Second, I reduced stress. I had just come out of an extensive stressful period, me versus parts of the U.S. government. And so I started meditation, and I had to do something different to survive. I went and visited Qi doctors in China, healers from Russia, witch doctors in Africa, Indians in the Northwest Amazon.
What did you conclude? Did any of them know more than the Western doctors?
I didn't have a lot of faith in the healers. But the one that I embraced was Ayurveda medicine from India. And I moved an Ayurveda doctor into my house for 6 months. And the herbs, the meditation, the chanting, and I took these hormones. I felt that there was an opportunity here using immunology to change my outcome. We need to accelerate research if I'm going to save myself, or I'm going to have to change how medical research is done. We created CAPCure, and the promise was we're going to double the money going into medical research. We're going to triple the money going
into cancer
research, and we're going to increase prostate cancer tenfold.
But today, you're in remission.
I'm in total suspended animation here. But I'm in, you could say remission. I've now celebrated my 25th year. The death rate from projected levels has fallen by 82%. There's millions of men alive today. I can see the end of cancer as a cause of death with treatment. The changes that have occurred in bioscience are so dramatic, particularly immunology.
What is it that you did that helped to change the way we finance health or look at it?
I would say first, you collected data. If you're going to accelerate science, it has to be based on basic science. So first, data. Let's check your microbiome. Let's sequence your disease if you have it. And then let's give you something that will work for you.
You talked about health. Are you an exerciser?
Yes. I would say it's two-thirds what goes in and one-third the exercise and the
so
lifestyle.
So are you a sports person, or you have just gym? What do you do?
Well, here was one of my problems. When I was 12, I was 5'11". Now at 72, I'm 5'9 and a half, okay? Right. And I did not grow one quarter of an inch from 12. So I was a star basketball player at 12, the player of the year. Then something happened and everyone else grew 2 inches and I didn't. I went from center to forward to guard to the bench to the stands, okay?
Let's talk about other things you're doing in philanthropy. You've been very involved in education. Why is education so important?
When I was in elementary school in the 50s, only 20% of jobs required a skill. Today, whether it's a skill or a semi-skill, 80 to 90% of jobs require some skill, some knowledge. And I think when we studied education in the 1970s, what we discovered was the United States was the most educated country in the world. And so other countries have now caught the United States and passed. And so, yes, we are the leader in higher ed. And as you know, as the former head of trustee of so many of them today, but we are strained in many ways in education. So our whole emphasis in our foundation was education. And that's why it was launched. And it was really the education I got that we didn't focus on the schools and for our employees as much as we should have.
So now you look back on your remarkable career, any regrets in your financial career?
Sure. There's a few people I wish I would have never met.
Right.
Okay. Or a few phone calls I wish I would have never returned. But I think also I regret that the American public didn't understand. Almost every person is high-yield junk. You know, when things started coming from Japan in the 60s and 70s, everyone said they were junk. It's junk. And then all of a sudden, we felt by the 80s, the quality of their products and cars was better. Everything coming out of China was junk. The American public didn't understand. They were talking about themselves. 60 million jobs being created by non-investment grade companies in the latter third of the 20th century, minus jobs being created by investment grade companies. And I think going forward, you know, I'm going to devote a large percentage of my time here to the American, what I call the living the American dream.
Now, you're creating a center for the American dream. So why don't we conclude with what do you think the American dream is all about?
I think the American dream, which is so unique, is a chance to succeed based on your ability. You're going to work hard, your knowledge, your insight, which is one of the most valuable qualities. Now, I can't tell you how depressed I am when I see that 26% of Americans under 30 think they're going to have a better life than their parents. Well, a long time ago, it was 90% of Americans. So why do they feel that? Why do 50% of Americans under 30 think socialism might be better than the free enterprise system? You can see socialism in Venezuela playing out. And so something is missing. And I think as I've been focused on it, one, it's hope. What I see is a large percentage of Americans don't see that hope. They have their student loans that are burdens for their entire life. Even if you go bankrupt, you can't get rid of your student loans. We have to eliminate student loans. We have to find another way to finance college. Two, someone tried to take their parents' home in 2008 or 9 or 10, or they lost their home. So their interaction with our financial system, they haven't really seen the benefits of it. We need to make sure that the financial system is working for them. It needs to, and it should. And it starts with education, and it starts with health, and it starts with access to capital. So for me, I'm going back to where I was 50 years ago.
Thank you very much for doing that, and thank you for your time today and very remarkable career. Thank you, Mike.
Well, thank you, David.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Thank you.